Hello, I'm Russell Rowland, author of 56 Counties, A Montana Journey. Welcome to 56 Counties. On April 10th of 1979, the Outlaw Inn in Kalispell, Montana, welcomed an army of people who had rented out the entire hotel for an undetermined amount of time. Among them was a short, slightly pudgy Italian man who had just earned two Academy Awards the night before for what would eventually be considered his masterpiece, The Deer Hunter. Michael Cimino had been dreaming for years of making a film based on the Johnson County Wars, a conflict that raged in Wyoming in the late 19th century, when wealthy cattlemen became tired of watching a flood of immigrants, inspired by the Homestead Act, to come into their territory and stake claims. These powerful men started a campaign accusing these people of rustling their cattle, sometimes with just cause, but mostly as an excuse to wage war against them and claim as much of the land as possible for themselves. Thanks to the success of The Deer Hunter, Cimino had finally gotten the green light to shoot the new film, and he had chosen a lush piece of land in Glacier National Park as the primary setting for most of the film. Cimino had managed to procure a promised budget of a little less than $8 million, so crews had shown up months before to start building sets and scouting locations for the various scenes. The very same day that Cimino arrived in Montana, the producers for the film held a meeting in Los Angeles where a heated discussion ensued about the possibility that the film was going to be way over budget. One of them even asked, "Should we be making this film?" When another replied that Warner Brothers was interested in taking it, a third replied that if they approached Warner Brothers to inquire about whether they would be interested in paying them what they had done so far, the word would eventually get back to Cimino, which would undermine their trust. So they decided to move forward despite knowing that Cimino had doubled the budget for The Deer Hunter and despite having no faith that he would finish this film in the allotted time. Back in Montana, word went out to the locals that they would be hiring extras not only to appear in the film, but also to build more sets and provide dozens of wagons and horses, especially for a huge climactic battle scene. Kalispell buzzed with excitement, and for the next 8 months, it served as ground zero for what most people expected to be another masterpiece. Little did they know that they were about to witness one of the biggest, if not the biggest, financial disaster in the history of filmmaking. Chapter 1, Joseph Cotton. The discussion about whether Heaven's Gate deserves its designation as the biggest flop in the history of cinema has waxed and waned over time, but a lot of the opinion about this film depends a great deal on what criteria people use to measure failure. It surprises me that among the books and articles I've read, including Final Cut, written by one of the producers of the film, Stephen Bach, and Cimino, a biography of the director by Charles Elton, that nobody mentions one specific piece of trivia. The opening scene of Heaven's Gate depicts a graduation ceremony from Harvard College, and the main speaker at the ceremony is a character called the Reverend Doctor. The man who plays this character is legendary actor Joseph Cotton in one of his final film appearances. In 1942, 37 years earlier, Cotton played Eugene Morgan, the second leading man, in another film that was directed by a young director who had just been crowned as the next genius by the film community. Cotton had previously co-starred in Citizen Kane, which is considered one of the best movies ever made. But once the director had universal praise heaped upon him, Orson Welles then produced and directed The Magnificent Ambersons, also co-starring Cotton. Welles became difficult to deal with during the filming of The Magnificent Ambersons, so the film went through several delays, several battles over editing and other particulars, and it got to the point where Welles eventually distanced himself from the production. The Magnificent Ambersons was the Heaven's Gate of its time, considered a financial disaster after RKO Pictures poured more than $1 million into the production, about $25 million in today's dollars. When Michael Cimino pitched Heaven's Gate to United Artists, his own masterpiece, The Deer Hunter, hadn't been released yet. And even though Cimino had only directed one film before that, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, also filmed in Montana, there was enough buzz in the film industry that people expected big things for The Deer Hunter. Cimino leveraged that momentum to negotiate an unprecedented amount of control over the production of what was initially called the Johnson County War. Cimino had brought The Deer Hunter in at around $15 million, which was double what the studio had originally allocated. But people forgive a lot when you win five Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. United Artists had also become accustomed to this routine, having just gone through a similar drama with Francis Ford Coppola while he tried to complete Apocalypse Now. Nobody would blame the failure of either the Magnificent Ambersons or Heaven's Gate on Joseph Cotten, of course. But it's interesting to ponder whether Cimino's choice to open what was supposed to be an epic follow-up to his most successful film with a speech from that particular actor wasn't a bit of an omen, especially considering that the first words Cotten speaks, the first words in the film, are, "My friends, if it be not a mere farce you are enacting." Chapter 2, Rising Costs. It must have been an exciting time to live in Kalispell in 1974 when Mr. Cimino decided to shoot Heaven's Gate in that town, which was around 10,000 people at the time. I talked to Bruce Robinson, who started working on the film as an extra, but because of his connections, eventually became one of the main coordinators for extras on the film. Robinson is the brother of Terry Robinson, founder of Montana's most successful band, the Mission Mountain Wood Band. Bruce played in the band himself after Terry was killed in a plane crash. Robinson confirms what many accounts about the film have reported, that the crew and the cast were convinced throughout the filming that they were part of a masterpiece. The attention to detail that Cimino devoted to this film became legendary, ordering clothes and furnishings from the time period, installing an irrigation system for the field where the battle scene was shot to ensure that the grass was green. When they went looking for a train for the scene where Kris Kristofferson's character arrives in Wyoming, there was one available in Idaho where they were to shoot the scene for $15,000. But Cimino found one he liked better in Colorado, and it cost $150,000 to buy and transport that train. He also had the entire town of Wallace, Idaho, rebuilt to resemble Casper in the 19th century. This included paying stores that had to close down for 2 weeks during filming for their lost income. Robinson points out that Cimino's perfectionism sometimes made the process grueling, particularly the scenes that were shot in a skating rink that was built specifically for the film. "We were all wearing this period clothing, which was entirely made of wool. Everything was wool, and it got to be close to 100 degrees in that building. But Cimino would still shoot take after take of every scene. He did more than 100 takes on some of those shots." Cimino's demands started way before filming began, with one of the biggest battles being his insistence that Isabelle Huppert play the leading lady. Although Huppert was a star in her native France, she was completely unknown in the U.S. And not only were the producers keen on casting a well-known actress, top choices being Jane Fonda or Diane Keaton, Bach was baffled about what Cimino saw in Huppert, whom Bach compared to a potato. She also barely spoke English. But Cimino threatened to go to another studio, a threat he would make often in the next several months if they didn't cast Huppert. The producers eventually approved of Huppert after flying to France to meet her in person. The rest of the cast was filled with rising stars like Christopher Walken, who had just won Best Supporting Actor for his role in The Deer Hunter, John Hurt, who was making his film debut in American Films and was just about to film The Elephant Man, Jeff Bridges, who lived in Montana by then, and Sam Waterston, who played the villain in the film. also a young Mickey Rourke. The budget for the film had already increased from $7.5 to $11 million before the movie even started shooting. And much to the dismay of the producers, Cimino had also sent them a letter just a few weeks before shooting began, insisting that he should not be penalized or held accountable for any overspending of the budget. It was normal procedure at the time for a director to incur some kind of penalty, either in his cut from the profits or from his own pocket for any overruns. Cimino's advance demands also included $2,000 in weekly expenses over and above his $500,000 salary. He also demanded that his name be listed on the title page of the film in the same size as the title, a request that baffled the producers considering this was rarely done in Hollywood and only for directors who had a long track record. Cimino's ego had inflated enormously since The Deer Hunter, and he hadn't even won the Academy Award yet. Oddly enough, every one of the executives agreed that they needed to meet his terms. It was a decision that would come to haunt them. Chapter 3, Trying to Rein in a Mule. New Yorker film critic Pauline Kael perhaps summed up the state of filmmaking in the 70s better than anyone. "Nobody really controls a production now," she wrote. "The director is on his own, even if he's insecure, careless, or nuts. Perpetually dissatisfied with the footage they're piling up, they keep shooting, adding rooms to the palace. Megalomania and art are the same thing to them." The main factor that caused the cost of Heaven's Gate to escalate was Cimino's glacial pace. 1 week into shooting, Cimino was 6 days behind and reportedly had only a minute and a half of usable film. He shot so many takes of each scene and printed each of them, which was very unusual except for a perfectionist. So the cost immediately began increasing exponentially, leaving the production team in the unenviable position of trying to figure out how to rein in the production without losing the trust of the director. Lee Katz, one of the United Artists executives, said in one of their meetings, "We seem to be in the ironic and paradoxical position of not trusting the gentleman with our money and therefore insisting that he take more." Cimino was so convinced that he was making a masterpiece that he doubled down each time they tried to restrain him. When one of the executives said in a meeting that the initial budget had been created with a crystal ball, word got back to Cimino, and he was so angry that he asked that this guy be removed from the team. There were two studio executives who became his primary contacts for the film, Stephen Bach and David Field. When Field tried to confront Cimino about the rising budget, Cimino simply stopped talking to him, even when Field flew to Montana and visited the set. To add to the pressure, Cimino refused to show the producers any footage, so they were forced to trust that he was making a product that justified the cost. Only 2 weeks into filming, Cimino was 10 days behind, but had shot 60,000 feet of film, mostly the same scenes over and over again, which prompted one more impromptu meeting among the executives about how to handle the situation. They discussed four options. The first was to let the film run its course and hope for the best. With their recent experience with Apocalypse Now, many of them were willing to take that risk, but Cimino was making it difficult. The second was to try to control and contain the costs, but Cimino was also making that option almost impossible by refusing to even communicate with anyone or to discuss a set schedule. The third was to replace Cimino with another director, and with as much money as they had already invested, that didn't seem plausible. The fourth option was completely abandoning the project, but that was almost immediately dismissed because of what had already been spent. Plus, there was always the chance that the film would be the masterpiece Cimino promised. So although they eventually agreed on the second option, trying to control the costs, they were never able to come up with a way of achieving that. The film was mostly shot in Glacier Park, and another added cost to production was the fact that the closest lodging to that location in Kalispell was a 90-minute to two-hour drive, so the entire crew had to be bused to the site every day. Chimino became obsessed with getting just the right light for each scene, so after the long commute, the crew would often spend the entire day waiting for the light to hit just the right angle. Bruce Robinson remembers many days where they rose at 3 in the morning to travel to the set, then spent most of the day waiting. They got paid overtime whenever they went over 8 hours, which happened almost every day. By June, 2 months into the production, Chimino had burned through $11 million and had shot only 26 pages of the 133-page script. What consistently kept the executives from shutting the picture down was the confidence in Chimino. When Field and Bach went back a second time to visit the set, they saw that Chimino was always the first one there, that he ran a very professional set, seldom losing his patience or his temper, and that the crew was all committed and happy to do whatever he asked. By late July, Chimino was still only halfway through shooting and had spent $16 million, more than double the original budget. So Bach returned to Kalispell with a member of their studio team, Derek Cavanaugh, sitting down with Chimino and telling him that Cavanaugh would be spending the rest of the shoot on the set, not to interfere, but just to give them reports of how things were progressing. Chimino told him to his face that he was fine with that, but when Bach flew back home, he received a letter the next day saying that Cavanaugh would not be allowed on the set or in the editing room and that he would not be allowed to speak to Chimino. The next trip Bach made on the 1st of August was with one of the studio lawyers, and they made this trip only after they had confirmed with the other studios that they were not interested in taking over the project. So Chimino couldn't throw that threat in their faces anymore. This time they gave him the ultimatum that he must finish the film by the end of September and that he would have a $25 million cap on the budget. Although Chimino eventually agreed to these terms, almost everyone knew that he wouldn't be able to keep his promise. There was something really special about this project, so even though people sometimes grumbled about it, the mood on the set was positive, Bruce Robinson says. I mean, we were on a movie set, and a lot of us got to be really close to each other. Some became closer than others, as was the case with Chimino's on-site producer, a mysterious woman named Joanne Chiarelli. Rumors had swirled even on the set of The Deer Hunter about Chimino and Chiarelli being involved in a romantic relationship. And even Charles Elton, who spent hours interviewing Chiarelli for his biography, was never able to get a straight answer about whether they were involved. But many people on the crew were shocked to learn late in the production that Chiarelli had secretly married the composer for the film, David Mansfield, who also had a role as the roller skating violinist in the dance scenes. The couple would eventually have a daughter that Chimino often claimed to be his own later in life, after Chiarelli and Mansfield divorced. Chapter 4, Finally, a Finished Product. Chimino did manage to speed up production over the next few months, and although he had produced about 1.5 million feet of film, which translate to about 275 hours of footage, he still refused to share any of it with the production team. He wouldn't even send them any still photographs. It was late September of 1980, a year and a half after shooting began, before Chimino finally announced that he had an early cut that he was ready to show. The production team anxiously met in L.A. for a private screening, excited to finally see a preliminary version of the film. Chimino warned them that he probably needed to cut about 15 minutes. That didn't prepare them for what was to come. They settled into their seats and were still sitting there 4 hours and 25 minutes later. The battle scene alone, which serves as the climax of the film, was an hour and a half long. Bach relates the conversation the production team had afterward, trying to figure out once again what to do about Chimino. And they again explored the idea of firing him or bringing in new editors. One of them said, "It wasn't that bad." To which Bach replied, "Yes, it is. It is unwatchable, intolerable." The other guy said, "Some of it is beautiful." And Bach replied, "All of it is beautiful, but it's still unwatchable." For the next few weeks, Cimino became even more inaccessible than before as he burrowed away with his editing team to try and whittle the production down. Bach fired Joanne Corelli, telling her that they could no longer afford to have her serve as a shield between them and Cimino. And she told him that she was relieved. She was tired of fighting all Cimino's battles for him. Much of the failure of Heaven's Gate can probably be attributed to the fact that long before anyone even saw the film, it had been all over the press for its overspending. When you have such a massive crew and more than 1,500 extras, there are bound to be negative stories that come out. Although other than the production team, it seemed that Cimino got along pretty well with the crew and the cast. But stories did come out, including one by a journalist that had tried to get an interview early on. When he was denied, he hired on as an extra and wrote an article critical of Cimino based on the several months he spent on the set. There was also the story by Willem Dafoe, who was still unknown at the time. Dafoe was one of the hundreds of extras who spent hours hanging out in the skating rink, waiting for the light to turn to just the right hue. One day, during one of these interminable waits, someone told a joke, and Dafoe apparently laughed too loudly because Cimino turned to him and told him to leave. Moments later, one of Cimino's assistants tracked Dafoe down and told him he was fired. Rumors about Cimino's behavior spread all over Hollywood, so by the time the film made its first appearance, after Cimino finally cut it down to 3.5 hours, people were prepared to hate it. The film premiered in 3 cities, L.A., New York, and Chicago. And it has to be said that there have been plenty of examples of films that had advanced press talking about how far they had gone over budget, only to have the film be a huge success. Apocalypse Now and The Titanic are two that come to mind. But the reason is simple. It's usually because of the quality. Chapter 5, The Demise. Bach's description of the premiere is painful as he and most of the cast sat through 3.5 hours of virtual silence. A large percentage of the crowd left at intermission, and the after party was nearly deserted. Initial reviews were so bad that the studio pulled the film out of theaters after only one day. Cimino cut it again to 2.5 hours, and it was released for a short run a few months later, but it again got scathing reviews. Vincent Canby of the New York Times wrote a line that became legendary. Heaven's Gate fails so completely, you might suspect that Mr. Cimino sold his soul to the devil to obtain the success of The Deer Hunter, and the devil has come to collect. Over time, though, the film has enjoyed a bit of a renaissance. There are even groups of people within the film community that believe the film is a forgotten masterpiece. European audiences who tend to appreciate films that don't follow a typical narrative form showed a particular appreciation for the film. The Venice Film Festival awarded Cimino a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2012. After watching the 2.5-hour version, which is completely incomprehensible, I was able to track down the 3.5-hour version, and there's no question the film is not as bad as it has been portrayed. For one thing, it is visually stunning. Cinematographer Vilmos Zsigmond had won numerous awards, including several for The Deer Hunter, and it's striking to watch how well he captured the setting for whatever film, no matter how different they were. In The Deer Hunter, he brought to life a working-class steel town and also the jungles of Vietnam, a sharp contrast to the open plains in Heaven's Gate, not to mention Harvard Yard. It's by far the best thing about the film. Visually, Heaven's Gate is comparable to another film that came out the same year, Days of Heaven, directed by Terrence Malick. But Days of Heaven is a wonderful film because it has a beautiful script. Heaven's Gate was plagued with sound and storyline issues. There are several scenes where you can't hear the dialogue. The story is also hard to follow, and the love triangle between Christofferson, Christopher Walken, and Huppert gets way more attention than the main storyline. Also, the battle scene, for all its authenticity, is a mess, in large part because Cimino brought in so many wagons and horses that the dust overwhelmed the set despite the underground sprinkler system. There are other problems. The opening sequence, which is breathtaking, is nearly a half hour long, and even after watching it twice, I was still not sure why Cimino felt compelled to devote so much time to this scene. It seems to have very little relationship to the rest of the story other than introducing two of the main characters, Kris Kristofferson's James Averill and John Hurt's Billy Irvine. Chapter 6, The Epilogue. The aftermath of Heaven's Gate was tragic in many ways. Not only did it result in the sale of United Artists to another studio, but Cimino, who was clearly a gifted director, became a pariah in Hollywood. Although he directed four more films, none of them came close to the quality he had shown in The Deer Hunter or Heaven's Gate. And of course, he was never given that kind of control again. Many major directors blamed Cimino for good reason for never having the same artistic freedom again. Directors like Coppola, Scorsese, Bogdanovich, and Robert Altman had worked hard to develop relationships with the studios that gave them more artistic control during the 70s. Studios showed more faith in the creative process than they ever had. Heaven's Gate changed that, and many never forgave Cimino, who became a recluse in later years. There were rumors that he was going through a transition in his final years, and photos seem to confirm this, as do personal accounts in David Elton's biography from people close to him. But according to others, he never stopped working, producing countless screenplays and eventually turning to fiction, even winning an award in Europe for one of his novels, Big Jane. For most of Cimino's life, his past was a complete mystery, even to those who knew him well. Cimino often spoke of a tormented childhood and having no family left. But Elton, the author of the biography, was able to track down two of Cimino's brothers who gave a very different version of their family history, claiming that Michael exaggerated the horrors of their family life. Because Cimino gave so little of himself, we'll never know what drove him to create his own version of the truth. But it's easy to see how someone with that kind of imagination would find good reason to isolate themselves from the world, just to keep their own version of reality intact. Perhaps the saddest and most telling fact about Cimino was a story Elton heard from a friend about a room in Cimino's house where he stored all of his projects. The room was filled with huge stacks of paper, but because of earthquakes in California, these stacks were disrupted so many times that they had turned into a mountain of paper. And Cimino confided to this friend that he had been unable to even enter that room in the last years of his life. You've been listening to 56 Counties on Yellowstone Public Radio. I'm your host, Russell Rowland, and I've been talking about the making of Heaven's Gate, considered one of the biggest financial disasters in the history of filmmaking. The theme song is written and performed by Aaron Parrott, and thanks to my son Fletcher for the rest of the music. Tune in again on the first Monday of each month for another episode of 56 Counties here on Yellowstone Public Radio.